Friday is Memorial Day weekend in front of NKS.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started with the Senate Committee on Judiciary. It's called to order. We have a number of bills today. What we're going to be concentrating on is getting our public hearings done as compared to working work sessions. I have a number of members that are here. The procedure I use, I try to get members in and out since they have other obligations. And so we may be opening, closing different public hearings to get them in and out and then reopening them for other additional testimony. But the first one we're going to start off with is on House Bill 3157A. Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3157A allows the Juvenile Director Oversight Committee to assume the duties and powers of a director of the Juvenile Department pursuant to a written agreement if certain conditions are met. There's no amendment, no fiscal, and no revenue impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good morning. Representative Huffman, how are you doing today?
Good, just fine. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Huffman, State Representative for District 59. And this is specific to my district. It's dealing with the regional jail called NORCOR, North Oregon Regional Correctional Facility. 3157 permits the Juvenile Director Oversight Committee to coordinate the juvenile detention facilities when an agreement exists between the local governments. About 11 years ago when we built NORCOR, there was a Chapter 190 organization created for both the adult facility and the juvenile detention, but somehow the sheriffs managed to get their working agreement codified in legislation, but the juvenile directors did not. So 3157 simply gives the same ability of collective oversight of the juvenile facility that the sheriffs have enjoyed the last 11 years on the adult part of the facility, and that's in a nutshell what it does.
All right, thank you. Any questions for the representative? Not seeing any. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on 3157A? Not seeing, we'll close the public hearing. And, Council, you said we're ready to go on this
we're
one?
We're ready to go on this one.
I'm
going to
open a work session on 3157A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3157A to the floor with a due pass.
All right. Senator Roquist moves House Bill 3157A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So order. Senator Wissett, will you be our carrier on this one? Thank you. And we'll close that work session. And, Council, where are we going next?
2604.
All right. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2604A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2604A requires state health plans, health insurers, health care providers that transmit any protected health information to include in annual reports descriptions of procedures to safeguard individually identifiable health information held in electronic or hard copy form. There are a few amendments on this one. One of them we don't have yet, and no revenue impact so far, and no fiscal impact so far. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlee, House District 33, Northwest Portland, West to North Plains. I'm presenting House Bill 2604, which is a continuation of the work done in the past session on protecting personal records and dealing with identity theft, and it deals specifically with the question of the safeguarding of personally identified health records. We've had some pretty significant breaches in the data systems, including personal health records. One in the state of Oregon a couple years back, which put at risk thousands of personally identified records of an existing healthcare system. The response of that system was pretty significant in dealing with that breach, although the CEO of the system in his first discussions of it pointed out he was going to find out who was at fault and get the thing straightened out, and they did. They spent actually millions dealing with that breach in a very auspicious way. But it also pointed out to me the similarities between that situation and some of the financial problems of some of the large corporations where the CEOs came in and said, oh my goodness, there's some problems here I didn't know about. This 2604 takes the Sarbanes-Oxley approach and requires the CEOs of healthcare systems to personally attest that they're familiar with the data security systems of their organization and that further that they've identified any breaches or any shortcomings in those systems and have notified their auditors and their board of directors of those breaches. It's a symbolically important thing. Those of us that have worked in healthcare organizations know when the boss asks for something, it comes up in a very different way than if the boss hasn't, and if the boss takes things seriously, then things happen in an organization. And this is intended to make sure the boss takes these things extra seriously because they personally will have to sign that they have reviewed these security systems and that they've done whatever needs to be done to make sure that personally identified information is available. I present to you the Dash A2 amendments, which present a 4-year sunset on this bill. It gives us a chance to get a couple of rounds of reports and see how it's worked out before we need to come back in the 13th session and decide whether it still makes sense or whether it's worked or it hasn't worked. And I hope you'll work the bill, amend it, and pass it on to the floor.
All right, thank you. Questions for the representative?
I have a question. Representative Green, apparently there's another amendment coming. Do you know anything about that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, no, I don't.
Thank you.
All right. I've got someone else that's going to be coming up. All right. Representative, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
I have one other person that's scheduled to testify on this. Gwen, how much time do you need? Why don't you come on up?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm General Counsel with the Hospital Association. I will speak very briefly and to the expected amendments. I hesitated on how to indicate for or against this bill on the sign-up sheet because we did oppose this bill in the House, but we would support the bill as amended by the expected amendments, and here's what they do. The expected amendments say that if those who are expected to file the report are in compliance with the HIPAA security regulations, that they would be deemed to be in compliance with this law. So if you're in compliance with federal security provisions, you wouldn't need to file the report. That's what we expect them to say. We, of course, have not yet seen them. We think that's appropriate because we don't disagree at all with the goal of this bill. We all need to be paying attention to patient privacy. There's no question about that. We just think that existing law, both federal and state, really has changed the landscape since even 2 years ago when the legislature met. And we are already heavily regulated in this area. If we're compliant with those regulations, we think that that does indicate adequate attention paid certainly by the hospital to the issue. If we're in violation, then that probably is an indication that our CEO and our boards need to be paying more attention. So we look forward to seeing those amendments and look forward to supporting the bill as amended.
All right. Any questions for Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony the other day on 2604? Not seeing anyone, we're closing the public hearing. And Council, where do we go from here?
2802.
We're going to open up our next public hearing, which is on House Bill 2802.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2802 increases the $500,000 non-economic damage cap on wrongful death and other statutorily created torts to $1.5 million. It indexes a cap based on the Oregon-Washington Consumer Price Index for all urban consumers for all items starting in 2010. Applies to causes of action before, on, or after the effective date, effective 91 days after sine die. There's no revenue impact, and that fiscal statement has been issued. It's indeterminate. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative out of the Albany area. House Bill 2802 comes to you from the Judiciary Committee, where it passed also from the House floor to here now. This bill was heard in our committee on April 7th, 2009. The intent of the original bill was designed to remove the cap of $500,000 on non-economic damages on any civil action except for torts against public bodies under the Oregon Tort Claims Act. Now, having listened to the testimony that Representative Barton and I had the opportunity to back on April 7th, obviously, to support the bill in the original version, two key questions had to surface. The first question that we considered was, absent a cap, would tort cases occur? And the second question was it possible to keep a cap and have the impact necessary to make this bill effective? And it's at that point then that we moved forward with discussion, understanding what the environment was 22 years ago when this cap at $500,000 was originally established. And from this point, I'll let Representative Barton continue.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brent Barton. I represent House District 51. This bill, I think, reflects actually something of a historic compromise. Let me explain precisely. It's actually fairly limited in scope. It applies only to wrongful death actions. And even then, it only applies to the cap of non-economic damages. So wrongful death actions. Essentially, when wrongful death actions are either the negligent or willful death of another, that's tortious. It's something that often perhaps tainted the discussion on the House side was conflating wrongful death with medical negligence. These are distinct tort claims, typically speaking. If you were to draw a Venn diagram, there'd be very, very little overlap. The most common fact pattern in a wrongful death action would be a drunk driver. And non-economic damages. And that would typically is exactly what it sounds like. It is for economic damages include things like medical expenses, lost wages. The non-economic damages in a wrongful death action are what are issue with this bill. And let me give you a hypothetical. And this is a hypothetical that is actually not that uncommon, unfortunately. Let's pretend all of us have a loved one, perhaps someone we've been married to for a long time, or a parent or a child. And let's pretend for whatever reason that person is retired, so such that there really is no income or wages. And let's pretend that person is killed by a drunk driver. Candidly speaking, there are not that much economic damages. There are no medical expenses. The person was killed instantly. And there's no lost wages. But yet one of the purposes of the tort system is to compensate. And what is the non-economic damages at issue? What is that relationship worth to you? How can you be made whole from that? And that's something, it's difficult. It's difficult to evaluate such a thing. And juries struggle with it. And in 1987, this legislature said that the maximum amount it could be valued by a jury would be $500,000. No matter the circumstances, it could not be more. It's been extremely controversial since that time. It has been, I think, an issue that has come up repeatedly. Indeed, the legislature narrowly avoided doubling it the following year in 1989, the following session in 1989. There was a movement that was narrowly defeated to double it to $1 million. This compromise, I think it's safe to say none of us necessarily like it. Indeed, the mere fact that it was a challenging compromise for me to agree to, but I do believe that this is right for the people of Oregon. I do believe that by reaching this amount and adding in an index, it will take a very contentious issue and perhaps remove it from the list of, shall we say, most contentious issues that this legislature confronts for a long time to come. And it's with mixed feelings, I think, that all of us agree to this, but I do believe it is right for the people of Oregon. I hope this committee can support this compromise. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Senator Wissett first, and then back over.
Representative Barton, do you have any figures on what tripling the non-economic damages here would do to insurance premiums?
Mr. Chair and Senator Wissett, I personally do not. I believe, however, that we're soon going to hear from Tom Holt of the Liability Reform Coalition, who was perhaps the third party to this negotiation, and he represents insurance companies that are within his coalition. He could probably speak to that better than I.
Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representatives. Question is, can you talk a little bit, speak to the indexing and how you came about that? And I see that it's percentage increase or decrease, so can you maybe explain how that would work?
Chair and Senator Dingfelder, I believe the language that LC used was taken almost exactly from, I believe, Senate Bill 326, I can't remember the exact number, which was essentially the OHSU, Oregon Tort Claims bill that was done today. So that actually how the mechanism was done, I think the exact language was taken.
Okay. And was there any discussion, Mr. Chair, was there any discussion about, because this is a new, it was not indexed previously, is that correct? And if that index will cover And we're going now, we're tripling from 1987, if that index will, in fact, keep up with the changes. So ideally, you wouldn't be coming back to the legislature to raise that cap. Is that correct? Or in theory, I mean, I'm assuming that's why you decided to index it.
Mr. Chair and Senator, that's correct. Because it was never indexed in 1989, this has become, shall we say, an increasingly aggravated issue, and the political pressure to remove the cap, I think, has significantly increased as $500,000 has become just simply what most of us consider, I think, not a fair sum. The theory behind this is that the tripling this plus the index, for better or for worse, will remove this issue, I think, from, shall we say, most particular political discourse for perhaps a generation to come.
Thank you.
Senator Boquist, do you want to segue on the generation?
Yeah, boy, I'd really like to know what that is. I'm not going to ask you a question.
He's not in our generation.
Yeah, right. It's just like, are we talking a decade? Are we talking 3 years? Are we talking about next session? But I won't ask that question.
Generation of legislators. We'll tell you how bad it is.
Having said that,
and Representative Barton, I'm going to let you off on that. I'm not even going to ask that question. Just for Representative Barton, is there a how did we pick 1.5? Why didn't we pick a million? And then I guess Representative Olson, why didn't we pick unlimited, which was what the original bill said?
Mr. Senator Boquist, originally we had my goal was to actually keep a cap. I did not want to remove the cap, and we'd had this conversation with some of you before. And we'd actually done an analysis of what would $500,000 look like 22 years later, and Anna helped us out with that. And it was just right in the neighborhood of $1 million. With further discussion with Tom Holt, with the coalition, that's where we moved forward, taking a look at a snapshot 22 years ago, and as Representative Barton shared, tried to kind of package into that what the climate was 2 years later, that the legislation attempted to move it up at that point to $1 million back then. So with that information, we moved forward, and that's where we came up with the $1.5 million right now, and we're tying it with CPI.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions for the panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here. Let's see. No other members are here, so we'll go ahead and continue on this one. Looks like I got a panel. Brian Beringer, Peter Bernardo, and Carla McKelvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Brian Beringer with the Oregon Medical Association. I'm here really to introduce two physicians that have come to talk about this issue. Dr. Peter Bernardo is a surgeon from the Silverton and Salem area, and Dr. Carla McKelvey, a pediatrician in Coos Bay, and then I'm available for questions at the end.
All right, thank you. Whoever would like to get started?
Shall I lead off? I have a time constraint this morning. Yeah, I will be brief. I actually have an operation to do, so I have to get out of here. Okay. Good morning. For the record, I'm Peter Bernardo. I'm the current president of the Oregon Medical Association. I've been in practice here in Salem for 17 years. And not unexpectedly, we're here to speak against 2802. And to the point for me, we, you know, as a state, have been looking at healthcare reform. And I know most of you have spent a lot of time on that issue in this session. I sat and worked with the Oregon Health Fund Board, and those recommendations are part of legislation currently. A big part, or it was acknowledged at least in the Oregon Health Fund Board, and acknowledged by many representatives and senators here today, that we have a problem with our medical liability system here in this state. We know that it's inefficient. The majority of the money goes to administration and to fees for lawyers, not to injured patients. We know that many claims never come forward, and many patients are never compensated. And our system needs to be fixed. We support reform and anything that will improve patient care, improve access to care. House Bill 2802 removes a limitation. It is not health care reform. It is not medical liability reform. We know that taking a cap off will change our premiums. We know that taking this cap off will affect further our ability to attract physicians to the state and keep them practicing to their fullest. So I keep it at that. This is not what we need in this state currently in this environment. We have difficulty enough providing care to our patients, and this will only make it worse.
Dr. McKelvey?
I'm Carla McKelvey, and I'm a pediatrician in Coos Bay in private practice. This is my first time testifying, so I'm going to read my comments because I'm a little nervous. I'm also concerned about the proposal to triple the cap in wrongful death actions. Tripling the cap will drive up the cost of awards and settlements, and this in turn will precipitate premium increases for physicians. While the exact premium increase is unknown, we do know from our insurance carriers that the rates for medical liability insurance will indeed go up in the wake of an increase. In 1999, the Oregon Supreme Court considered the constitutionality of the cap on non-economic damages in non-death tort actions in Lakin versus Cinco. The court found that the cap was unconstitutional. After the Lakin's case, physicians' premiums, including mine, for professional liability coverage essentially doubled from 2000 to 2004. It is predictable that if the legislature were to triple the cap in House Bill 2802, the severity of claims would again increase, resulting in an increase in the cost of medical malpractice insurance coverage. It is difficult to predict what that increase would be. Regardless, the cost of doing business by physicians must be passed on to the consumer. Approximately 50% of my practice is Oregon Health Plan or have no insurance. Therefore, it is patients with private insurance who will see the increases. This is due to the fact in rural Oregon, the margins for such increases are razor thin, and a significant increase could mean the difference between keeping the doors open and closing down a practice. As members of the committee can appreciate, one of the major issues facing Oregon is the ever-escalating cost of health care. The goal that has been expressed at both the state and federal level is to contain those costs and to the greatest extent possible reduce health care costs moving forward. That is the goal of House Bill 2009. Passage of House Bill 2802 would be counterproductive to that goal, and the committee should refuse to take action on the bill for that reason. One other thing to keep in mind is that Oregon currently subsidizes the malpractice premiums of rural providers through the Rural Medical Liability Reimbursement Program. Funds for this program will run out at the end of 2010. When that happens, obstetricians, certified nurse midwives, and family practitioners with obstetrical services will lose their premium assistance, which is anywhere from 60% to 80% of their premiums. This is a significant disincentive for rural practitioners. Adding premium increases to the mix will be catastrophic for rural practitioners and their patients. When Coos Bay loses one obstetrician, 25% of the pregnant women in our community lose their doctor. And that's just not Coos Bay. We cover Reedsport also because none of their doctors provide obstetric services. It is a significant loss in a small town such as ours where there is a significant population on the Oregon Health Plan. Please reconsider tripling the cap.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for the doctors?
Just a very quick question, Mr. Chair. Obviously, there's other testimony. We all got emails from the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition. My guess is OMA is not part of the Reform Coalition. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, actually, the OMA is a part of the coalition, and every once in a while you have to break from a coalition when you find that you need to. And I would just say that this is one of those situations where we had to take our own path.
I have a quick question.
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, do you happen to know, and I may need to ask the prior panel, the portion of wrongful death cases that have to do with medical negligence as opposed to other types of actions?
I can't answer that.
We can get that and come back.
Thank you.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you. I just would like for you to reiterate and expand a little on the chilling effect that this enlargement of the cap could have on rural physicians who practice in fairly high-risk medical practices such as orthopedics, pediatrics, and so forth.
Whenever the previous cases came down and the malpractice insurance premiums went up, we had serious conversations within our community about obstetrics in particular. And we were very worried about losing all of our obstetricians. Obviously, as a pediatrician, it's important to me to have good obstetricians in the community because that makes better babies. And so there was a lot of discussion about what we were going to do related to that. And to be honest, what was very fortunate was the subsidy program came along, and it allowed our obstetricians to stay in practice. If you combine the loss of that subsidy and an increase in the premiums, I think we are facing the same situation again. When the physicians in Reedsport quit practicing, those patients came down to Coos Bay. It's a 30-minute drive, which is a beautiful drive during the summer, but became quite scary during the winter time. And so to sit there and say, what happens if there's no obstetricians in our area? The next closest place would be Eugene, which is a 2-hour drive. It is a much scarier drive, especially during winter time.
Thank you. Just a comment, in the five counties that I represent, we have that same significant population problem with, I think we're 18 physicians short in Klamath Falls right now, and that is the hub for Siskiyou and Modoc County in California, Klamath County, and Lake County and portions of Crook. So it's a situation that's just ready to implode.
Yes.
All right. Thank you all very much for being here today.
Thanks.
I have three other people that are signed up, Tom Holt, Jim Dorgan, and Jim Gardner. And while they're coming up, just checking the room, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on 2802? Looks like Hal Dinger. And if you, Hal, if you want to come up and just grab another chair, we'll have four up here.
Tom, you want to get started? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt on behalf of the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition. Representative Barton and Representative Olson, I think, gave a pretty good explanation of what the bill now does and how we got there. I'm really just here to say that, you know, we were part of that discussion. It was a difficult discussion given the subject matter and the compromise that we reached with the amended bill, while one that probably causes a great deal of discomfort on both sides of the issue, is a fair one. But I'd be happy to take questions.
All right. And whoever wants to go next.
I'll testify next. Thank you, Senator Prusansky, members of the committee. My name is Jim Dorgan. I'm the Senior Vice President and Regional Operating Officer for the Doctors Company in Oregon. We insure approximately 40% of the private practice physicians operating in the state. And the cap on non-economic damages and medical liability that was repealed in 1999 was effective in keeping Oregon a good place to practice medicine. Non-economic damages are generally most prevalent in medical malpractice cases because most other types of litigation against professionals deal with only the economic side. So when the cap was repealed in 99, on all non-economic damages, the price for insurance for doctors increased by over 200%, depending on specialty. In Oregon also, we were competing for physicians with California that has a non-economic damage cap of $250,000. Idaho has a non-economic damage cap of $250,000. So we stand out as a place that is not friendly for medical professionals to practice medicine. A limit on non-economic damages discourages non-meritorious cases. Raising it will erase this benefit. So if we have an unlimited potential recovery, I think we're going to see more wrongful death cases in Oregon. And we don't need more litigation at this point, which will drive up the cost of insurance. As was mentioned earlier by the OMA, Oregon faces serious deficiencies in access to care. We need to make Oregon a more attractive place to practice medicine rather than less attractive. This bill will negatively impact access to care. There are very few cases, but the potential of huge damages in these cases is frightening for physicians. It will cause them to continue to modify their practice or decrease higher risk specialties. The average doctor in Oregon has policy limits of $1 million per occurrence, $3 million annual aggregate. This means that any potential wrongful death case just on the non-economic damage side, will carry any lawsuit against physicians above their policy limits. And I think that's dangerous to physicians. They're going to look at ways to cut back their practice to less risky procedures. In 1999, after the cap was knocked out, we had a number of neurosurgeons discontinue operating on minors. Access to care for pediatric neurosurgery was greatly damaged. We had, by some estimates, 25% of the doctors delivering babies discontinue. So the impact of removal of cap is severe in the medical arena. California, one of the other issues that's discussed is, does it limit access to courts? And in California, where there is a cap on all the economic damages of $250,000, the frequency of claims against physicians has remained constant. There's no comparison in this $1.5 million cap to the OHSU cap. The OHSU cap is an absolute cap of $1.5 million for economic and non-economic damages. What we're looking to do is keep a cap in place that has been effective, and we are proposing no limitation on the economic damages that are put forth in lawsuits, which are the loss of wages, loss of earning, and medical expenses, which in many cases can far exceed $1 million or $1.5 million, especially in cases in obstetrical cases or long-term care. So we feel very strongly that in a system that has been fragile, which is the medical malpractice market in Oregon, that any modification of this cap is going to be damaging to the provision of health care in the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Hal, did you have something else you want to add to this?
Jim said most of what I wanted to say. I'm Hal Dassinger with the Doctors Company. But I think it's worth adding that Jim mentioned that there are relatively few cases.
You can sit down.
Thanks. Jim mentioned that there are relatively few cases where non-economic damages are high enough for the cap to be in play. But it's worth pointing out that raising the cap or eliminating it altogether has the potential in every claim for outsized damages, and that affects the way the doctors view their practices and the way the insurance company views every claim. You have to reserve claims differently. It's a negative impact for every physician and patient. But the potential benefit of raising the cap only accrues to a very few patients and their advocates.
All right, thank you. Jim?
Mr. Chair, to avoid repetition and conserve your time, I'd simply like to submit our written testimony.
All right, thank you very much. questions for anyone on this panel? Senator Bonamici first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does anyone in the panel know the percentage of wrongful death cases that are from alleged medical acts rather than something like a traffic accident that Representative Barton mentioned?
I don't know a statistic on that, but I would say that there would probably be a pretty high number, pretty high percentage, because the physicians treat ill people and a number pass away, so there's always allegations.
Just a follow-up to clarify.
You bet.
You said, Mr. Dorgan, in your written testimony and in your oral testimony, that the number of wrongful death actions tried in Oregon resulting in non-economic damages of $500,000 or more is very small. Is that because of the cap, or is that because there are just few cases where there could be damages alleged above the $500,000 cap?
Well, on any case, damages could be alleged above $500,000, but generally the juries tend to keep the non-economic damages below that amount. What we'll see, and also the pleadings are not high because they know that a case will be limited by the courts after the fact, so they don't shoot for the 5 or 10 million of non-economic damages. What we saw after the cap was lifted in 99 on general non-economic damages is the amount of the demands in lawsuits increased. So we'll see a case... I would anticipate seeing a case where the economic damages are fairly small, and then we'll see a $5 or $10 million non-economic damage demand, which will scare the defendant in the case and push it more towards settlement. So I think it will cause it'll make it more difficult for us to settle cases that should be settled.
All right, any other questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair, yes.
And Senator Wissett.
A couple of questions for Mr. Holt. On the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition, Mr. Holt, did they believe that the Supreme Court got it wrong in their decision?
Mr. Wissett, Senator Wissett, the issue in the recent Supreme Court case is whether a limit is constitutional, and the court ruled that it is. Based on history of when it came into play, I believe, and I think our coalition generally would agree that a limit is imperative in good policy.
And the second question, Mr. Chair, is again with the coalition. Did the coalition study the effects that this would have on the various different sectors, such as medical malpractice and others? I mean, individually, or did you just, how did you come about deciding that this was a good compromise when obviously we have some other people that you represent do not believe so?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Wittsit, given the timelines of a session, there was not an opportunity to do any kind of an in-depth study of who it would affect and how. And I think it's a fair assumption that any time a limit is increased, to the extent that cases tend to go toward coverage limits of what people carry for insurance, then that's going to require people to carry higher limits and therefore increase their costs. But we did also look at the overall context that Representative Olson and Representative Barton discussed, that had the $500,000 been inflated to today, just using the CPI, that we'd be in the vicinity of $1 million, and then there were some other issues in play related to that led us to the figure that's in the bill.
Thank you.
All right, one other question, and this is just, I guess, for Hal or for Jim. Regarding the doctor's company, I noticed that you're headquartered in California. I'm assuming you provide insurance for other doctors in other states. Can you tell me how many states you write policies for?
We write policies in all 50 states, although I have to tell you that in New York and other venues with where tort reform has not been enacted and where there are no limits on recovery, there are some states like New York, Pennsylvania, where we insure very few doctors. But we do have doctors active in all 50 states.
All right. Thank you very much.
Senator Brzezinski, as you recall, when we were on the governor's task force on medical liability reform, I was then CEO of Northwest Physicians Mutual Insurance Company. As part of the issues as a result of losing the cap, we looked for a larger partner to continue to be able to insure physicians, and we sold out to the doctor's company in 2006, and the doctor's company is also a physician-owned medical malpractice provider, meaning that it's owned by its policyholders.
Great. Thank you for the clarification. And if there's no one else, I believe, that wanted to give testimony today on 2802, we're going to close the public hearing. And the council, and we just work our way through the next.
2585.
All right, we're opening up a public hearing on House Bill 2585A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2585A repeals the prohibition on class actions for unlawful trade practices, Truth in Lending Act, and similar lawsuits. Applies retroactively unless a judgment was entered before the date of enactment. Declares emergency effective on passage. No amendment, no revenue impact, and minimal fiscal. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Gentlemen.
Chair, Vice Chair, committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm Jay Sickler, the founder of a firm named Cogence Group. I'm a CPA and a financial damages expert, having testified as a qualified expert witness over 80 times in federal and state cases and private arbitration matters. I practice exclusively in the areas of economic loss, damage analysis, forensic accounting, and business valuation. Before founding Cogence Group, I spent 21 years with various accounting firms, including Deloitte & Touche and Ernst & Young. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2585. Oregon's Unlawful Trade Practices Act, UTPA, provides that a successful plaintiff who can prove he has been damaged as a result of willful fraudulent activities can recover his actual loss or a minimum of $200 of, quote, statutory damages. No doubt statutory damages are allowed under UTPA and many other state consumer protection statutes because it may be difficult to prove the actual dollar value of damages in many cases without the testimony of an economic or accounting expert witness. The cost of such an expert can unfortunately be expensive. I bill my time in financial damage matters at $400 per hour. My professional staff are billed at between $155 and $180 per hour. It must be noted that the cost of such expert is not recoverable under UTPA against a wrongdoer by a successful plaintiff. A current exception in Oregon to this provision for statutory damages, unique to Oregon law, is that a class action cannot be used to recover such minimum statutory damages. Thus, in cases where there is a large fraud, where it may be proved that many Oregon consumers were damaged due to fraudulent acts, the wrongdoer escapes with the money and escapes responsibility because each damaged class member must prove the exact amount of his injury. They cannot be awarded Oregon statutory damages. In a large fraud, this can mean hundreds of thousands of dollars or more don't get paid to the victims. Because the cost of an expert cannot be recovered under a UTPA, there are many situations in which the wrongdoer escapes being held accountable.
Jay?
Yes.
We've got your written testimony. I'm going to let the committee read through the rest of it. So if you want to summarize instead of giving us the examples, that would be great.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In many cases, there's numerous records that have to be reviewed in a case such as this. So if you've got a number of plaintiffs that have varying economic damage amounts, where there is a number of documents in a file, a case file, for instance, that need to be reviewed, the cost of having somebody involved like myself or my staff to review that information and summarize would obviously be substantially more than the couple hundred dollars that may be lost on a per plaintiff basis.
Great.
All right, thank you. Bob?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Robert Stoll. I'm a retired attorney in Portland. I'm testifying in favor of House Bill 2585. Basically, this bill brings Oregon in line with the law in every other state in the union. Oregon is the only state that has a prohibition against class actions for minimum statutory damages. And so it effectively, in the if you have a massive consumer fraud going on in Oregon, because the cost of hiring an expert, the damages vary at all between the class members, it makes it prohibited to bring a case for actual damages. And so then you're, you should be entitled to recover the minimum statutory damages. But in Oregon, because of this unique law we have in Rule 32K, you cannot bring a class action for that. So that's why there are these various groups in support of this bill.
All right, thank you. Questions for the panel? Not seeing any questions. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Was anyone else who wanted to give testimony on 2585A? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2585A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2585A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 2585A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussions?
I won't be supporting this at this time, at least. I haven't really had time to read through the testimony. But in general, I think that this is something I can't support.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to support it, but may go the other direction after I've reviewed it some more.
I understand. All right, so any, this is the only objection at this point, Senator Wissett, with that supported. And Senator Bonamici, you'll be the carrier on this
Thank
one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2585A. And we're going to open up our next public hearing on House Bill 2434A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2434A decreases the statute of ultimate repose for large commercial structures from 10 years to 6 years. It applies to causes of action arising on or after the effective date, exempts large commercial structures owned or maintained by homeowners associations or associations of unit owners, and exempts public bodies as defined by ORS 174.109. There's no amendment, no revenue impact, and no fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Let's see. I've got, looks like four people want to give testimony today. I've got Drew Higginhorn, Jeremy Bermelia, I believe, and then Paul Snyder, and I believe it's Dean Aldrich. Aldrich. And so why don't y'all come up, and we'll grab another chair, have four up at once. That's fine. Even though you may be on different sides, you can all play together.
Do well.
And Drew, I'm going to let you go first since you're one of the proponents.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Drew Hagelin for the Associated General Contractors testifying today in support of AGC sponsor House Bill 2434A. This legislation would reduce the statute of ultimate repose for certain commercial construction defects from 10 to 6 years. This is the third consecutive session that AGC has advanced a repose-related piece of legislation, and the first thing I want to let the committee know that is that this is a very different bill from what you've seen from AGC in the past, and that's because we've taken pains to reach out to various stakeholders who traditionally have opposed our bill. Those include the Oregon Trialers Association, as well as public sector owners, including local governments such as counties and cities, ports, etc., and address their concerns. And I'll let Paul speak for himself, but I know that he and also the Oregon Trialers Association is neutral on House Bill 2434A. For the Oregon Trialers Association, we at Section 1.1C excluded or retained, rather, a 10-year statute of ultimate repose in instances where a homeowners association or a condo association is involved. We did so because we recognize that really, in those contexts, we're dealing with residential type owners more than we are commercial, more sophisticated commercial owners. So that's why we accommodated that request, and that addressed the Oregon Trial Lawyers' concern. We also excluded public entities, cities and counties and so forth, as I mentioned earlier, from application of the law, retaining the 10-year statute of repose for them. And we did so because the 6-year statute of limitations for contract claims at ORS 12.250 is not applicable to public entities. So that was the rationale behind retaining the 10-year statute of repose for public entities. The legislature already spoke to the public policy behind that. In addition, this is the third consecutive legislative session that we've addressed this issue because it's very important to us, and the problem is continuing to get worse. It obviously is partially due to international markets, but it also has to do with the fact that Oregon represents less than 1% of the national liability insurance market. In addition, our neighboring state, Washington, has a 6-year statute or liability tail for both residential and commercial. Some of our other neighboring states also have lower statute of repose. So it creates an unfavorable regulatory marketplace here in Oregon for insurers to come in and write business. And today, we don't have very many. And indeed, our contractors are paying far more for liability insurance and receiving less in exchange. Exclusions are on the rise and so forth. I'm going to turn now to legal counsel to AGC, Jeremy Vermilia. He's going to talk to you about 2007 AGC consumer protection reforms per House Bill 3242, which this legislature passed and the governor signed. That bill was all about raising the standard of practice in the commercial construction industry by preventing problems before they happen. And that bill addresses a number of the concerns in the written submissions before you. He's also going to brief you on the 2008 Court of Appeals case, Waxman v. Waxman. That case also, I think, addresses some of the concerns that were raised. Two of the anecdotes and the written materials you have, I believe, would be barred by the precedent in Waxman. So I'll turn now, Mr. Chair, with your permission, to Jeremy, who will outline those issues for you.
All right, and Jeremy, as you outlined, I'd like for you to please summarize. I'm not sure if you had written testimony or not.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's a memorandum in the packet that you got that I wrote a while back relating to a number of these issues. For the record, my name is Jeremy Vermilia. I'm a construction lawyer and reside in Tigard, Oregon. I represent owners as well as commercial contractors, and I am also the counsel to the board of directors of the Associated General Contractors. As you all may recall, in 2007, the AGC brought forth a bill, 2434, at the time that essentially raised the standard of practice in the construction industry. It did essentially five key things. Number one, it increased
the amount of experience that a contractor must have in order to obtain a commercial contractor's license endorsement. Number two, it increased the amount of their license bond. Number three, it increased the amount of liability insurance that they must carry. Number four, it instituted a program of requiring annual continuing education in order to maintain your contractor's license. And finally, it imposed a 2-year building envelope warranty on all commercial construction projects, and with that imposed a maintenance obligation during that 2-year period as well. So there were a number of things that that bill did which went to increasing education, increasing best practices, increasing code compliance, and some of the other things that were raised in the letters that were presented to you by Forensic Waterproofing Consultants and by Western Architectural. The idea at the time was that that bill would go hand in hand with a repose reform bill as well. Unfortunately, that repose reform bill did not pass in that session, which is why we're back here. With respect to the current 2434, and I meant to say 3242, I'm sorry, I have the numbers transposed. what this bill would do would be to limit for commercial construction claims only, and only for subsequent purchasers, that is, the second owner of a building. It would make the limitation period on a construction defect claim 6 years, which is effectively what it is for original purchasers now as the result of the case of Waxman v. Waxman, which I believe you have in your packet as well. That was a case where the court essentially said that the discovery rule, which applies in negligence cases and allows for a claim to be brought within 2 years after the date which it is discovered, it says that that rule does not apply to contract claims. Under a prior case, the Jones versus Emerald Pacific Homes case, the court had held that absent a special relationship between a purchaser and seller of a project, that a tort claim doesn't apply, that all the rights and remedies arise out of the party's contracts. In the commercial context, virtually every case you're going to see is going to be governed by contract. I cannot envision a circumstance where you would have a special relationship situation arise where you would have a tort claim be available to a purchaser of a commercial building, and therefore virtually all original purchasers are going to be bound by a 6-year statute of limitation. The Waxman case says that the discovery rule does not apply and so limits all claims on the contract claim to 6 years. So what we're really trying to do is address the difference between what the statute of limitation is for a commercial purchaser, original purchaser, and what it would be for a subsequent purchaser. Essentially what we have now is a strange result where a second purchaser actually has longer time to sue the builder than does the original purchaser of the building, the person with whom the contract was originally let. We're trying to remedy that gap and make those two sets of claims consistent, as well as make them consistent with what Washington and I believe Idaho has a limit of 5 years as well on their construction defect claims. And again, remember that this only applies to claims arising out of large commercial construction, except for those that are governed by residential homeowner associations, condo associations, town homeowner associations. With that, I know you're short on time. I'll hold off and see if anyone has any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Dean.
Yep, I'm here opposing it. And
I need you to state your name for the record.
Yes, my name is Dean Aldrich, and I'm here on behalf of some private property owners who contract Venerable Properties, as well as some we've gotten statements from. I've submitted written materials, and I will summarize briefly my opposition to this. This is a bad idea, and it's a bad idea because, as we can see, it's been around 3 times before. The other thing is there's a large class of owners who are not exempted from this. Large commercial structures under the statute, which is proposed under House Bill 2434 to go from 10 years to 6 years, includes everything except for small commercial structures and residential structures. And I've attached definitions onto my submittal. And that would include, for instance, large condominium complexes. It includes large residential structures. It includes hospitals. It includes nonprofit buildings, healthcare facilities, and so forth. There have been some carve-outs by certain entities who've had lobbying presence here through either OTLA or through the public bodies, and now we're left with exemptions from the 10 years to the 6 years for certain classes of building owners, but not for others. And those others are people who are nonprofit who may own, and private entities who may own identical buildings, such as we've submitted a couple of statements from Community Action and Thomas Edison High School. These are folks who discovered their problem in their high school's educational facilities at 9 years. Those folks would be out of luck under House Bill 2434. There's no rational basis to distinguish between identical buildings based on differences of owners, and that's one of the main problems. You also have House Bill 2434, which reduces the rights of owners for buildings that are already constructed. It applies to causes of actions that accrue after the date of this. So owner who negotiated for a 10-year statute of limitations or statute of repose now is out of luck after the passage of House Bill 2434 because they did not discover their defect within 6 years. Also, because it is a repose, owners may not be able to contract around it, regardless of their sophistication. I mean, that the folks who are getting their rights and protections range from mom and pops to nonprofits to large sophisticated commercial owners. And there's no rational basis to distinguish between different types of owners. Next point is 10 years, not 6, is appropriate. Many defects are discovered after 6 years. There was a construction claims task force that had an insurance study that was done pursuant to the 2005 legislature. That report came out in 2006. They reported 30% of the problems occur after 6 years. Those are the reports that are done as well, and the statements that are done by building consultants that I've also submitted along with my statement. I appreciate the fact that we're trying to get buildings right, but you got to get buildings right. Then this 10-year versus 6-year doesn't matter. We've got to ask ourselves, why are we going from 10 to 6? What benefit does it serve? And I've just heard some allusions to insurance coverage. As representing owners, many times, and contractors as well in contract negotiations, we contract for 10 years. We contract for insurance companies. The owners are happy to pay that additional premium because that's a small percentage of what the repair costs that happen when a defect is discovered after 6 years. Also, most states allow 10 years or more with my materials. And again, if we go back to the work that's already been done by the Construction Claims Task Force, 27 states allow 10 years or more. There's only a small amount, 9 states, that allow 6 years or less.
Again, we have to ask ourselves why. What's the benefit of this legislation? What's the cost? Also, I think it's important to mention the standard commercial contract that's entered into on
large commercial structures, you know, whatever they are, again, that definition is overbroad in the statute, they allow up to 10 years. AIA 201, the 2007 version, the most recent version of the standard commercial contract allows 10 years as a default ultimate repose period. House Bill 2434 does nothing to solve the problem of poorly constructed buildings. We've already made some progress with the statutes that went into place that Mr. Bamiri talked about. But getting people off the hook for responsibility for buildings before 10 years is not the way to go about this. I mean, there's a Honda facility, distribution facility, that had a roof collapse that occurred after 6 years. We've got current cases right now where we have a retirement facility, mandated low-income housing and apartment building that went bad after 6 years. These projects, I mean, run into the millions of dollars, and under House Bill 2434, that burden would be solely based on owners. Also, 2434, you've heard Mr. Vermilieri talk about Waxman v. Waxman. We got a big problem with respect to conflicting cases, conflicting statutes. We're adding to the mix. It's going to increase litigation here. We're trying to do a carve-out of certain classes of owners who only get 6 years as opposed to 10. They try and carve out homeowners associations. Homeowner associations don't
matter. I think we've got the understanding as to the, let's say, carving out. I'd like for you to summarize if you have any other points so we can take questions.
Yeah. This bill creates more actual problems than any purported solved problems it purports to solve. We're dealing in vapor here. This causes problems.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions?
Did Mr. Snyder, is he going to add anything?
Oh, Paul, I'm sorry. Did you?
All right, Mr. Chair. Just very briefly, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. Thank you. We are neutral on this bill. We believe what it does for public bodies is basically a restatement and clarification of current law as it applies between ORS 12.080, 12.135, and 12.250. The interrelation of those statutes, we believe, and this bill reiterates, that the statute of ultimate repose and the statute of limitations for public bodies is 10 years. For those reasons, we're neutral on this bill. And we do appreciate the cooperative and collaborative way that VGC works.
All right, thank you. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask about the Waxman case deals with the statute of limitations in contract claims. When there is a case of this nature, do the plaintiffs typically assert other theories?
Well, the Waxman case is pretty new. It was, I think it was issued in December of this past year. So it's still very new. It's unclear yet what the plaintiff's bar will do to deal with that decision. My read on the case is that, and Mr. Aldrich can probably talk about this from his point of view, but I think what the case essentially says is if you're the first purchaser, whether, and by the way, these two nonprofits that are been raised here would have been, their claims would have been barred under the Waxman case, which is a statement of the current law. This bill wouldn't have affected those people's rights. They would have been barred under Waxman under the current law no matter what. But with respect to Waxman, I think what Waxman is saying is if you are a first purchaser, whether it's on the commercial or the residential side, with the exception of a public body, if you have, in the absence of a showing that you have a special relationship with the builder, you've got 6 years to bring your claim. I suspect that what you'll see is you'll start to see a lot of development of evidence or attempts to develop evidence to show that there was, in fact, a special relationship. I also think that on the commercial side, given the nature of the relationships between the parties, that's going to be very difficult. Commercial, the relationship between a contractor and a buyer on the commercial side is very different than the relationship between a contractor and a buyer on the residential side. Oftentimes, you'll be the contractor on the commercial side is using the forms that are given to them by the owners, and the owners have got lawyers, and you have a very sophisticated negotiation of terms and a risk allocation. You don't have that on the residential side. You're usually using the contractor's contract form, and the buyer gets what they get. So you have to keep that in mind because of that. There is probably more likelihood that as the case law develops that you're going to see the ability to generate evidence of special relationships on the residential side. I think that that's unlikely to happen on the commercial side.
Can I ask a follow-up quickly? Is the Waxman case on appeal? Has it been
appealed? That was a Court of Appeals decision,
yes.
And I'm not aware that it's on appeal. Tripped my LexisNexis to tell me if there was a notice of appeal, and it hasn't done anything, and it's been now several months, so I don't think it is on appeal.
Yeah, and just one brief follow-up, Mr. Chair. Has there been any, I know that 3242 is fairly recent. Has there been any sort of survey of the industry to figure out how it's working?
Not as of yet that I'm aware of. Some of the provisions in 3242 aren't going to go into complete effect until 2010 because it's a rolling implementation. So the answer to that question is unfortunately no at this time.
Thank you.
All right.
May
briefly.
Yeah. Senator Bonamici, Mr. Vermilieri responded to what the plaintiff's bar is doing. Usually there is a negligence cause of action that's brought in addition to the breach of contract cause of action. The impact of Waxman is not entirely felt. This bill is not consistent with Waxman or with negligence law currently that's in Oregon. There's ways around Waxman. He's talked about special relationship, and the statements that I have provided from Mr. McGuire and Ms. Ness at Community Action and Thomas Edison High School, those were special relationships in addition. Also, there was negligence claims that were brought. With that, Waxman is actually having some untoward effects towards contractors. I think it's beyond the scope here, but that goes to my bottom line. Question, you need to look at this in a comprehensive manner. We just can't carve out certain owners at one particular time.
All right, thank you. Other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Anyone else who wants to give testimony on 2434A? Not sitting on, we close out public hearing. And now we're going on to our next public hearing, which is on House Bill 2306.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2306A increases the amount for vehicle and homestead exemption in bankruptcy proceedings, adds floating and manufactured homes to the exemption, and declares emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It looks like we have a substitution here of counsel.
Mr. Chair, you're correct. I'm David Niebel. I work for the Oregon State Bar. I'm appearing on behalf of the consumer section of the bar. Mr. Carnes was planning to be here, but he's sick, so I'm pinch hitting. This bill is pretty straightforward. It increases the amounts that are exempt from execution for debtors who have been sued and who owe judgments. And it also protects debtors' property in bankruptcy. The exemption statutes in Oregon have been relatively low with respect to exemptions allowed in other states. And this bill increases two of the most important exemptions, the homestead exemption and the exemption for a vehicle. The homestead exemption currently is $39,600 for a couple and $30,000 for an individual debtor. This bill would increase the exemption for a couple to $50,000 and for an individual to $40,000. It also increases the vehicle exemption from $2,150 to $3,000. Finally, it eliminates a distinction which is in current law among different kinds of homesteads. Currently, there are different amounts exempt for floating homes, manufactured dwellings, and site-built homes. This bill would eliminate that distinction. This bill is a compromise between the financial lobby and consumer advocates, and it's a reasonable bill that balances the interests of both parties, and I would urge your passage.
All right.
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Niebel? Senator Boquist.
Thank you. Just a quick question. Just refresh my memory here. If you have a $50,000 homestead exemption and you go into bankruptcy, I thought I remember you could keep one house or something like that. How does that apply?
I'm sorry, if you have a...
If you're in bankruptcy, I thought last time I checked, you could keep a home, the original home or something. But
you, Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, the way it works, as I understand it, is that you declare bankruptcy and you are allowed to have, if your equity in a home is $50,000 under this bill, if it's $50,000 or less and you're a couple, you're able to keep your home. If it's more than $50,000, then if your equity in the home is more than $50,000, the home would be sold. You would get the first $50,000 and then the excess would be distributed among your creditors.
Yeah, it varies from state to state as to what the exemptions are. Some states actually will, in fact, exclude, I think, the home itself. Yeah. I don't know if they even assign a value to it or not, but it's state by state. Any other questions, Senator Wissett?
You may have covered this, but did you say when the last time this exemption was raised?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wissett, it was these were both raised in 2005.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2306A? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing, and we'll go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2306A.
Mr. Chair, move 2306A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2306A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Dingfelder, will you carry this one?
Certainly.
And we'll close that work session. And our next public hearing is going to be on House Bill 2790A. And as council's getting ready, Brian, you're here. I've got Marilyn Lawrence, I believe, and Kevin Campbell.
Sorry about that, Mr.
Chair. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2790A adds one member who is a non-management parole and probation officer to the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training, changes membership in some policy committees, requires review of administrative law judge decisions by policy committee. There's no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, and no amendment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Brian DeLeishman, I'm here representing the Oregon Council of Police Association, the Oregon State Police Officers Association, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. If you have any, caution, if you have a file on this and you have any letters in opposition to it, I think you can scrap those. In an attempt to come to consensus, we met on the House side. The bill you see in front of you passed the House unanimously. It does a couple of things on behalf of my clients. We attempted to do two primary things. One is add a parole and probation officer to the board. There is currently none, even though they train and certify parole and probation officers. We wanted to add a couple of additional line staff to the Corrections Policy Subcommittee. There are currently no local corrections officers on that policy subcommittee. We thought that was a benefit. And then also adds two additional police officers to the police policy subcommittee. In addition to that, the other goal of the legislation was to speed up the process as far as the revocation or decertification process. We believe this bill actually accomplishes that as compromised, and we would urge our passage.
All right, thank you.
Chair Pruszanski and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kevin Campbell, Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. Had the privilege of sitting down with Brian to work through this in Maryland for DPSST, and we can support the consensus result here, which is, I think that's two this session. We're setting a whole new tone for the future.
Two for 100 or what?
Well, I don't know, but I think we're making good progress. And with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we hope you'll support House Bill 2790, engrossed.
Mr. Chair, just to set the record, we're two for two on the ones that have come in front of you, and you have a couple more, and we plan to play nice on those, and you'll see another one. There may be one lane out there still this session, but it won't be in front of this committee.
Or my other committee either?
I can't assure you of that.
I want 1,000 if we can. All right. Thank you very much. Marilyn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Marilyn Lawrence. I manage the Standards and Certification Program for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And you have heard good summaries of the bill and of the work group process. I would just like to reiterate that the work group did focus its discussion on how to address the concerns of the bill's proponents while removing the unintended consequences that would have had some significant fiscal and policy impacts on the department. We are pleased to support the consensus process, and the bill as you see it today has no fiscal impact on the department. Thank
Great.
You.
Thank you very much. Questions for anyone on the panels? Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on 2790A?
Actually, I do have a simple question.
Thank you.
Senator? Why was it decided that the Oregon Department of Forestry position would be not be kept on the board?
Marilyn, question.
Again, this is Marilyn Lawrence, Chair Pruszanski, and Senator Whitson. The Oregon Department of Forestry is not a regulated body by the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. They have a fairly narrow interest in terms of wildland firefighting. but they are not an entity within DPSST's general regulatory structure. They retain a position on the Fire Policy Committee, which is the body that deals with specific fire issues of concern. But because they are not in the broader regulatory structure, it was thought that their interests could be adequately addressed by adding them as a dedicated position on the Fire Policy Committee, but not having them serve on the larger body, which votes on the general areas of regulation for the department.
Did they? Did the Department of Forestry oppose that to removal of their position?
I do not believe they did, sir. Eric Gablix, who is our deputy director, had some specific conversations with the Department of Forestry, and he could probably answer that question if I'm in error.
Eric Gablix, Deputy Director for the Department of Public Safety, Standards and Training. After the work group meeting, we went and met with Department of Forestry. They were not pleased that they were going to go off the board, but they understood that their policy initiatives, as Marilyn stated, would still be met by being in the Fire Policy Committee, so they have not opposed the legislation.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions?
I just think it's a great idea to go.
Thank you. All right. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2790A. I'm going to go ahead and open the work session on House Bill 2790A.
Mr. Chair, move 2790A to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2790A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So order. The chair will carry this bill, and we'll close the work session on 2790A. And we'll open up our next public hearing, which is House Bill 2335A. And is Bill in here? 2385. And who's the 2285? Is that all it says? All right, so we've got to wait for Mr. Taylor. And I'll tell you what, let's stand down, Diane, if you'll put us in a recess mode for a moment. We're back on the record, and we're going to open up a public hearing to continue testimony that was already started on House Bill 2335A. And I had Shen White, and then Alex Gardner's here as well. Alex, why don't you come up too? And there's Shannon. And Shannon, I'm going to let you continue since you were testifying before. And before you get started, just give us a summary.
Chairman of the Committee, House Bill 2335A comes in from the Oregon District Attorneys Association. It states that after a decision by the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision not to grant parole to an inmate, a subsequent parole hearing may not be held sooner than 2 years after denial and no later than 10 years from the date of the prisoner's sentence to life. Sentence a dangerous offender a sentence for a crime committed prior to November 1, 1989.
Shannon.
Thank you. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, my name is Shannon White, and I'm the Associate Director with Partnership for Safety and Justice. Continuing my testimony specifically on the bill that was just introduced, I understand that there seem to be a number of amendments floating around, and just to be clear, I'm solely addressing the issue of extending parole board hearings to a maximum of 10 years between each hearing. And I wanted to come back before you today to finish the testimony, because we do feel strongly that this effort is not appropriate at this time. The The reason for the bill, of course, is to minimize the trauma experienced by victims of parole board hearings, and we understand that that's a very serious issue and one that needs to be addressed. We participated in the parole board's work group, which is seeking right now to address some of the concerns that were raised in the hearing last Friday of the victims who are being brought into these hearings. But what we need, what we feel needs to happen more further is for victims to actually be provided with services throughout their experience, starting at the time of the crime, throughout the parole board process, and at any point in their lives when they need services, and that that is what's truly lacking from our system right now, and that this bill is not addressing that really core issue. And I think you all may know, our organization, along with our allies, have worked very hard this session to keep the funding for the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund, which is just a piece, of course, of the victims and survivors who are impacted by crime. But it is something that we support strongly, and we hope maybe during better economic times, crime victim services can be expanded to support people, particularly through the parole board process. I do want to point out that this work group met extensively and that this bill is not at the recommendation of that work group, nor did it come at the request of the parole board. And I think that's because there are some potential downfalls with it, part of which is that, you know, as we know, the rehabilitative services with inside prisons have taken a sharp decline in the last 15 years. So contact with the parole board is oftentimes a prisoner's only opportunity to get some feedback both on their progress and the direction that they need to take. Again, it's an area where programming actually inside the prisons would be a far better avenue to address this problem, so people were not coming before a hearing without an opportunity to really get support to address the problems that may be brought up by the parole board. We don't think this is a time to afford prisoners less contact with people who can actually point them in the right direction when at this time we have very little programming within prisons to do that. I do finally want to point out that most of the people impacted by this bill were sentenced prior to 1989. So that means that anyone who would be impacted by this bill has already served a minimum of a 20-year sentence. And my reading of this bill is that there is no criteria that would prevent the board after that first hearing from then extending it to another 10 years. The criteria that's been outlined is fairly general and does not narrowly focus on the kinds of situations that I think were brought to the attention of this committee on Friday. So, you know, finally, I think the parole board has taken a funding cut, which is actually going to further decrease their ability to do the limited services they're able to do right now for victims. That is an area that is going to make their job harder, and that not having contact with prisoners is not a good resolution for that. So just particularly given the leadership changes at the parole board right now, we think this is untimely and unwarranted. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Alex.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. I'd like to begin by saying that no amount of victim service...
First, your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Alex Gardner. I'm the Lane County District Attorney. No amount of victim services would mitigate the damage done to victims when they have to reconfront the person who killed a loved one or put them through this process in the first place. This isn't something we can address by having more victim services at the local level. And there are procedural adjustments that can be made which would adequately address some of the concerns which were just raised. The two principal components that address most of these concerns are a provision for the offender to ask for a sooner hearing if there's been some change in circumstance. As long as there's a mechanism to petition for earlier release, if there's been such a change, that's addressed. The other is that we can require that there be particularized findings on the part of the parole board which justify the extension in time. The case in point is the Diane Downs case, when the record is full of bases upon which an extension would be merited. I should point out that I am also only testifying as to the original 2335 and not the 19 amendments that I understand are now in the system. But I want to mention one thing because I've had an opportunity to read a couple of the amendments. I think the committee is aware of the economy that is achieved through the downward departure system. The vast majority of downward departure sentences, I'd say upwards of 90%, are achieved only through stipulation of the district attorney. That's because most of the time there is no factual basis upon which the court could find, make the necessary findings in order to justify the departure. I look at, in looking at the combination of the 7th and the 11th amendment, I see that it potentially redefines what a year means. So it basically, a year sentence means anything, any sentence which could be reduced to a year by virtue of good time or other procedural reductions. The net result is if the DA stipulates to a sentence of, say, 24 months or 18 months upon a downward departure and the person violates probation, the net result could be a 60-day sentence, or a sentence not to exceed 60 days. The cost of that would be shifted to the counties, which can ill afford it, but the real cost is going to be to the state, because very few DAs are going to agree to a downward departure sentence if the net result upon failure is 60 days in the local jail. So I think what we would see is more litigation at the trial court level, and then a lot more determinant sentences in Salem. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't remember if this was discussed in the prior hearing, but how many people are we talking about if it's only designed to apply to a prisoner sentenced for a crime committed prior to November 1st of 1989?
Chair Kozanski, Senator Bonamici,
the answer to that. Yeah, Steve Powers can give us the answer later.
Okay, and then a brief follow-up. I know that there was a concern raised about the trauma to the victims of having to sit in the same room as the defendant or the prisoner. Can they appear by video or be in another room so that they aren't in the same in proximity?
Chair Przanski, Senator Bonamici, members of the committee, I think the principal concern is the matter is never put to bed. It's never even put to bed for more than 14 months. Even if some alternative appearance might be arranged, the fact is that maybe a year goes by before the whole matter is surfaced again. And for somebody who's had a daughter killed, that means it's an annual torture, really.
Mr. Powers, why don't you sign in? And two questions that have come up. One is about how many people are pre-89. I understand from your testimony last week that we also have ongoing new cases that are coming into the system. And also, if you could answer Senator Bonamici's question regarding other alternatives for the victim not being in the same room.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. For the record, Stephen Powers, Chairperson of the Oregon Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. The number of offenders that this bill affects is all 1,600, or approximately 1,600, under our release authority. That includes those whose crimes were committed before 1989. That's roughly about 700 or so of those 1,600. The balance of those 1,600 are crimes committed after 1989 that are still under our release authority. And as the chair pointed out, those are continuing crimes. And so there are crimes today, aggravated murder, murder, and those sentenced as dangerous offenders who are under our release authority and would be affected by the change made by 2335A. With respect to the second question, in terms of other options, there are other options for victims to appear by telephone. At this point, there is not a video ability, and also they can appear by sending a letter to the board. And those options are also there for the board in holding its hearings with offenders. We have a number of offenders who DOC houses on the east side, and we have them by video conference, but that is also in the institution. We go into the state penitentiary to hold those video conferences for safety and security reasons. But part of the work group that was mentioned, and again, this is not a work group bill, is to look at other options to get testimony or statements to the parole board and looking at the locations of hearings, but we know that affects more than just us, and so that'll be something that the
board will be exploring in the next year.
And can I ask one more follow-up? And I guess I'll ask Mr. Powers, what factors would be considered in making the determination about whether the time should be extended to 10? 10 years seems like a long time. Currently, to go from 2 to 10 seems like a pretty big leap. So how would that decision be made? How would the decision be made to, whether to go to 4 or 6 or 8 or up to 10?
Chair Przanski, Senator Bonamici, we're looking at the text of House Bill 2335, and there's two things that are in the bill in terms of whether the board makes a finding that they wouldn't be ready for parole. I'm not paraphrasing quite accurately, but that's in there. And then there's a requirement in here that the board promulgate rules that are consistent with Article 1, Section 15, and the values embodied for criminal law. And so we would be looking at that. I can't articulate anything more than that, other than we'd be looking at, is this person, as I understand the spirit of the bill, is this person likely in 2 years to be ready at that point, where we would have an affirmative finding for release, or is there an extended period of time warranted because where they are at isn't going to, in 2 years, it's not reasonable that they would be ready at that point, and so maybe 4 years, 6 years, or the maximum of 10 would be necessary.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions? Thank y'all very much. I'm assuming there's no one else who wanted to give testimony today on this bill here, which is 2335A. We're closing the public hearing, and I'm just going to, just for the record, open up a public hearing on 2285A, which we did last week. No one was here then. No one. Is there anyone here today that wants to give testimony on 2285A? Not close the public hearing. All right, so that takes care of yours. Yeah, it's in our set.
Okay.
We did it. What do you mean?
We had everything we said.
We had a hearing.
Yeah.
Okay.
We had a hearing back last week.
All right. Waiting for counsel to change positions. And let's see. We do have a couple of people who were here previously that wanted to give testimony on some different cases. And I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing to take that testimony in on House Bill 2441A. And I believe Gail and Andrea Myers were the two that were not able to testify when we had the first public hearing. And so if you two would like to come forward so we can get your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. With respect to this bill that would do away with the corpus selecti rule in Oregon on certain crimes, I'd like to point out to the committee something that makes Oregon unique in the nation in the way in which we adjudicate our criminal cases. And that is, Oregon is the only state in the union that tolerates a 10-2 jury verdict in order to convict. 48 states, the federal government, the federal territories, all insist upon a unanimous jury verdict. Only Louisiana tolerates an 11-1 verdict. We are the only state in the nation that tolerates a 10-2 verdict. So at the outset, we have to appreciate and understand that we really, as a state, allow for a lot of reasonable doubt in our jury deliberations and still result in a conviction. Secondly, this bill does apply to crimes that so when you do have a victim of a sex crime who is less than 12, you are going to potentially, depending on the charge here, potentially result in a mandatory minimum sentence of up to 300 months. The concern that was raised and identified by Bronson James in his testimony, he is the appellate lawyer with the Public Defense Services. His comments we would also voice as well, that when this bill was being discussed over on the House side, we all sort of had blinders on, and we all sort of all thought that this related to a statement that was made to a law enforcement officer or someone in their official capacity who was investigating a crime, who had a position of care or authority over the victim. But in effect, the way in which it is stated does not contain that limitation. It simply says, a confession alone is sufficient to warrant the conviction of the defendant without some other proof that the crime has been committed. A confession alone. And what Mr. James testified to is confession under Oregon law is not restricted to statements made to law enforcement officers. It's related to anyone. You can make a statement to your golf buddy on the third green, and it constitutes a confession under Oregon law. So this bill would allow anyone to assert that someone else made admissions to them about sexual conduct to a vulnerable victim, and they would get scooped up within this provision. So you could have an employee fired by an employer, and the employee could then come in and say, the employer confessed to me that he had had oral sex with his two-year-old nephew. And this would get scooped up in that. We think that the corpus delicti rule has served Oregon very, very well since statehood. And it came over to us from Britain, and there's a reason behind it. In feudal England, a gentleman confessed to murdering someone who had vacated, who had disappeared from the village, and so they took the confession seriously, and they executed the person who confessed, and then 2 years later, the purported deceased walked back into the village, and they realized, oops, I guess the confession didn't mean much. So since then, England has insisted upon there being some other proof independent of the conviction before they'll convict. That came to us over from England. It was part of our roots. It's been with Oregon since statehood. I guess the question is there any way in which we can structure a process by which if there is an admission to a vulnerable victim that we do allow and sanction that? There was an amendment over on the House side that allowed for these statements to come in if they had been electronically recorded. That's something that would give us a lot more comfort, especially if you have issues of translation where you have a foreign non-native speaker and you have an interpreter and translator. But absent those sideboards and absent an amendment that would clarify that the statement needs to be made to a law enforcement officer or a federal officer, we would oppose the bill.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, simply here to join in opposition. I wasn't able to be present at the hearing on the House side, but present here today, I simply wanted to echo Gail's concerns on behalf of OCDLA, which she carried on our behalf on the House side, and would urge this bill not move forward this session. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for either of the witnesses? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you. Have you seen the A5 amendments, and if so, could you comment on those?
I have seen the A5 amendments. These were
sponsored by Representative Golson Gelfer in an attempt to address the concern that was raised
by Bronson James. So when the bill reads that the confession alone is sufficient to warrant the conviction, and confession not being limited to simply a law enforcement officer, the -85 amendment is an effort to at least make the relationship between the defendant and the person to whom the defendant confessed relevant for the jury. But in my view, in our view, there's a difference between the evidence being relevant and what would be relevant now for consideration under the A5 is the bias or the motive of the person who's coming forward and declaring the defendant confessed to me. It now will be relevant evidence as to that bias or motive. But that doesn't eliminate the possibility of bias or motive. If you restrict the bill to a confession made to a law enforcement officer or a federal officer, you will have eliminated the bias and the motive that someone else might have to make a false claim. So in our view, the A5 amendment does not remove our concerns of the way the bill itself reads, which is simply allowing a confession that could be made to anyone.
Other questions? Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. If I understand your concern, for instance, this would allow an alleged confession made to a DHS caseworker to be unchallengeable in court if it were regarding someone who were an alleged sex act against a person who is of diminished mental capacity. Is that correct?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsett, members of the committee, it would certainly allow it to come in. It would certainly allow that statement to form the sole basis for the conviction. It would, the defense would always have the ability in court to contest whether or not the statement was made, or if made, was meant to be taken seriously. So the defense would have the opportunity to contest the statement. But this bill would allow that statement of itself to constitute the entire basis for the conviction without any other corroborative evidence of the crime occurring.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions for the panel? All right, thank you very much. And we're going to go ahead and close the continuation of testimony on House Bill 2441A, close that public hearing. Now, what we're going to do is we have one bill that we're going to go ahead and open up a work session on. This is on House Bill 2874A. We have a dash one amendment that had been discussed during the public testimony, which we had not had a chance to incorporate into the bill. And so the chair would ask, well, I guess first, counsel, why don't you just give us a summary so members know which bill 2874 is.
House Bill 2874A allows victims to assert the right to a speedy trial and created a procedure for asserting the right to a speedy trial. The Dash 1 Amendment provided the victim's assertion of a speedy trial right did not supersede a defendant's constitutional rights.
And this is one that apparently there was some discussion on the House side as to thinking that the amendment had been incorporated into the bill, but apparently it had not been. And so the chair will take a motion on the adoption of the Dash 1s into the bill.
Chair moves the A1 into 2874.
Senator Boquist moves the dash A1s into Senate Bill 2874. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. All right, we're going to go ahead and close the public the work session on that bill for now. And what we're going to do at this point is we're going to go through our schedule. I believe we've taken care of everything that we needed to get in on public hearings. We now have all the bills ready to move forward for work sessions. What the chair is going to do, we will carry over all of the bills that are on today's agenda that have not been worked out of the committee. And so first of all, the caveat for everyone is that if the bill has worked through this committee and has now been assigned going to the floor with a carrier, those bills are done. All of the others will be carried over until tomorrow, which is Wednesday, May 27th. And if I have this correct, and this is the dangerous part, but first of all, the intent is to make certain all bills that were not worked to conclusion will in fact be carried over. So if I missed one in this review, and it's basically all of them are being carried over for work session at this point. We have two of them at the beginning that are possible reconsideration for work session. All the others will be for work session. And if I have that correct, it's going to be House Bill 3295, House Bill 2246A, House Bill 2434A, House Bill 2802A, House Bill 2604A, House Bill 2285A, House Bill 2335A, House Bill 2344, House Bill 2175A, House Bill 2478A,
House Bill 3271A, House Bill 2727A, House Bill 2238, House Bill 2339A, House Bill 2874A, House Bill 3263, House Bill 2502A, House Bill 2629A, House Bill 2713A, House Bill 2290A, and House Bill 2441A. Again, the intent of the chair is to carry all of the bills over from today that have not been worked to conclusion with a going to the floor with a carrier, and they will be carried over until tomorrow, which is Wednesday, May 27th. So, colleagues, you'll realize that there's been a lot of these bills have multiple amendments, so you may want to take a chance to catch up on those amendments. Those who are here today realize that some of those bills will not be worked tomorrow because we could be waiting for other amendments, or there may be other issues that need to be addressed. And so it's possible that some of these bills that were carried over till tomorrow will, in fact, be carried over to Thursday. Lastly, committee members, because of the amount of work we still have, we have 7 bills tomorrow which have public hearings, 2 on Thursday. There is a possibility that we will need to come back on Thursday in the evening after the Environment Natural Resources completes its meeting to conclude our work if we're not able to get it all done by the end of Thursday's scheduled hearing. With that, Council, anything else?
I hear you say we're going to work these bills and about 7 more. That's all. That's it.
We have 7 more. We have 7 more for public hearings scheduled for tomorrow to get all the House bills that we needed in, with 2 there, 2 additional ones on Thursday. So we have a total of 9 that have not had public hearings yet. And then we have these, and there may be a couple that have been carried over until tomorrow that weren't in this stack. But those are ones that we carried over from last week. I can't remember if we carried them all over to Tuesday or some to Wednesday.
Is there a possibility that we can instead of Thursday evening? We can make it Thursday evening, and my committee may have it Thursday. And we don't have evening calls to have this canceled.
Okay, and so my understanding, we may be able to do some of the additional work tomorrow in the early evening after the conclusion of committees. We'll check on that to make certain we wouldn't be in conflict, but we definitely have a room. So it could be tomorrow, Wednesday, or it could be and or Thursday as necessary. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. With that, we're adjourned. Suzanne?